The topic today is financial responsibility, and the subtitle they gave it is "The Man Who Has the Gold Makes the Rules." And when they sent that to me in a letter, and I thought, that really sounds crude. Did you get a handout? Okay. Everyone got one? And so they said, if you don't like this, you can let us know and we'll change it. And I thought, man, I'm going to change that. And then the more I thought about it, I really realized that that's true. And we may not like it, but the world we live in, the man who has the gold makes the rules. Proverbs 22:7 says that the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. And so whether we like it or not, that's the facts. And so we kept that subtitle on that. This handout that you have will tell you everything that I'm going to say today, except for a few jokes that I throw in. And in fact, we won't even be able to make all the points. About 2 months ago, I did this talk in 9 hours, so you're getting the condensed version today. But you can follow along, and if I skip a point, don't get lost. Just keep going down, and that means I just skipped a section. It's got a section on giving, and you just heard a great talk on giving, so we'll just skip giving. At the back, there are some sheets with some charts and information on them, and we'll be looking at those as we go along, and I'll let you know when to look at those. You know, our money and how we handle it, how we earn it, what we do with it is important to God, like Wayne was just talking about. In Jesus' 38 parables, 16 of them dealt with handling possessions. In over 70% of the marriages that fail today in our country, the primary source of conflict is money. And so today I want to look at the biblical principles concerning how to handle money. You know, the world has a lot to say about money. It tells us we ought to use MasterCard so we can have clout, and ought to get a loan with bank accounts with automatic overdraft and all this stuff. But as a rule in the Christian life, if you just stand the world on its head, then you're going to be right. Just do the opposite of what the world's doing. Walt this morning said, he asked the question, have you embraced God's value system in your life? And so I just want to ask you, have you embraced God's value system concerning your money? And let's see what his value system is. Luke 16 tells the parable of the unrighteous steward. This was a fellow who was a business manager or an agent for another man. And the boss figured out the man wasn't handling his assets right. I don't know if he was stealing from him or just not handling them right. But he called him up and said, hey, I want you to get your books brought up to date because I'm going to fire you. Now, that man violated one basic principle. Never let a man know you're going to fire him ahead of time if he can hurt you. This unrighteous steward went out and hurt the boss, and he'd go to one customer and say, hey, you owe my boss 100 measures of oil. Let's just make that 50. You'll owe me a favor. The guy said, man, that's great. And so he went around doing this, making friends for himself, so that after he left that boss's employment, he'd have some folks that owed him a favor. Well, Jesus didn't commend that, but he said that the man was shrewd in the way in which he handled money. In Luke 16:10-11 in the Philippi, it says, the man who is faithful in the little things will be faithful in the big things. And the man who cheats in the little things will cheat in the big things too. So if you're not fit to be trusted to deal with the wicked wealth of this world, who will trust you with the true riches? That verse calls the wealth of this world little. You know, and in God's economy, it really is. It's not a big problem to God. But how we handle it is what's important. If we handle the little things, if we handle the money that God allows us to have, then he will entrust us with things that are more valuable than that, things that have eternal value. So, like Wayne said, God's the one with all the wealth. And you and I are just the stewards. Now, if God chooses to give one man $100,000 a year to manage for him, and he chooses to give another man $50,000 a year, and he chooses to give another man $10,000 a year. In the world system, we say, oh, this guy over here with 100 is really sharp. The God system doesn't work that way. That just means that this man is accountable to God for more. And he's no better, no smarter, or anything. It's just that God, for the time being, is entrusting more of his assets to him. or God's assets, not that man's. And so we're just the steward. God's the one with the wealth, and we're the steward. And the important thing is we need to be faithful in handling what God allows us to have, so that we can be entrusted with things that are more valuable than money. Well, we can be good stewards financially in four areas. One, in how we earn an income. Second, in giving. Third, in saving. And fourth, in how we spend the money. But before I look at those, I want to talk about a couple of things that are some misconceptions about money. The first one is that money brings happiness. You know, there's two camps in the Christian ranks today that we hear, and one of them is they sell this what I call the gospel of prosperity. You know, they say that it's God's will for everyone to be rich. Well, the only problem with that deal, I have a friend that says, if you're going to preach that, you better preach it in America, because it won't fly in Haiti. You know, the problem with that deal is you take an old boy and he's walking with the Lord and growing and getting along great with the wife, and then one day he goes to work and they shut the plant down, or the boss cuts his pay, or they fire him, whatever. He goes home, and if he ascribes to this philosophy, not only does he have to worry about coming up with the money to pay the bills, but he's also got to worry about what he did to make God mad. You know, and so he gets down on the downward spiral. Ecclesiastes 5:10-11 says, he who loves money shall never have enough. The foolishness of thinking that wealth brings happiness. The more you have, the more you spend, right up to the limits of your income. So what is the advantage of wealth, except perhaps to watch it as it runs through your fingers? So, and the other camp, the opposite of the gospel of prosperity, is what I'd call the gospel of poverty, which they teach that money is evil, and we as Christians should forsake all worldly goods and should not try to be a success in our career and so on. But, you know, and they say real heavily on 1 Timothy 6:10, the verse Wayne just talked about, where it talks about the love of money. You know, money's not evil, but it's our attitude toward it. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. You know, money is neither good nor bad. It doesn't make a man or break a man, but it does reveal him. If I've got a couple of $100 in my pocket, I've got some choices that I wouldn't have if I had $2 or $3 in my pocket. You know, if I decide I want to go out some honky-tonk and have a good time, with a little more money, I can do that. If I want to hop on a plane and go to Las Vegas and carry on, then I can do that. If I don't have any money, then it makes a lot of decisions for me. So money does reveal what we're really like. But it's our attitude toward it that's important. Love of money can cause a man to do several things. One thing it can do is cause a man to forget God. Have you ever noticed that as a man's net worth goes up, as a rule, his interest in spiritual things goes down? That's because being hungry is a tremendous spiritual motivator. It's hard to be stuck on yourself when you're hungry. You have no choice but to trust God. Deuteronomy 8:11, that is the time to be careful. Beware that in your plenty you don't forget the Lord your God and begin to disobey him. So if God is blessing you right now, you just beware so you don't forget him. Now, love of money can choke out spiritual growth. Mark 4:19 says that the cares of the world and the delighting riches and the desire for other things enter in and choke the word and preach unfruitful. Cares of the world and the delighting riches. Let's look now at earning an income. First area of financial responsibility. Like I say, I'll be skipping some of these points, but the first thing in earning an income is just the principle that hard work does pay off. I had a friend that was a used truck dealer here in Oklahoma City for a number of years, and he had a saying that a blind hog will find an acorn if he keeps rooting. You know, we're going to have some good things happen if we just stay after it. Proverbs 28:19 says, hard work brings prosperity, playing around brings poverty. So hard work pays off. Second, find a job where you can love your work. Ecclesiastes 5:20 says, to enjoy your work and to accept your lot in life, that is indeed a gift from God. The person who does that will not need to look back with sorrow on his past, for God gives him joy. So find a job where you can love your work. Now, you may be in a job that looks like a dead-end street, You may be in a job where your boss doesn't treat you right or appreciate you. Well, don't leave here and quit that job and say, Kirk told you to do it. Don't go from something to nothing. That's a sign of extremely limited intelligence. But, you know, if you're in a job that you can't enjoy, then you may need to go to school a little bit and get some training. That's what you're doing right now, isn't it, John?
Mm-hmm.
You know, John's decided what he wants to do, and he's going to school to get some training. He works part-time in the evening and sometimes. But you may need to go to school and get some training. You may need to spend some time maybe as some kind of apprentice. In other words, you know, maybe not make quite so much money right now, but in the long run, be prepared to have a career that you'd enjoy. But find a job where you can love your work. I like what Walt said this morning, that as a layman, my vocation is my pulpit. You know, the non-believing world is watching those of us who profess to be believers. And they're watching how we do our business, how we handle our business. Because it's easy for me to say, hey, I'm a Christian, but if I chisel folks that I do business with, then they're going to hear my actions a lot louder than they hear my words. I had a situation yesterday. I called up a fellow who sells to me. I've done business with him for about 10 years. And in my business, you see like a manufacturer's rep that comes to sell to you. You might see him once every 2 or 3 months for 5 minutes. So you don't have a real in-depth relationship with him. I called him up and asked for some information. He said, hey, before you leave, let me ask you a favor. And I said, fine. And he told me about his 30-year-old brother who'd fallen out of some bleachers and broken some vertebrae in his back. And the doctor said the guy should be dead by now. And he said, will you pray for him? And I said, you bet. I said, let's just do it right now. And so by long distance, this fellow, I don't even know if he's Christian. If he's not, he was one-shot fellow praying by long distance. But we prayed for his brother. But I've never witnessed to the guy or anything, but either some sign is on my office. Somehow he knew I was a Christian. He figured that I could pray for him. But be a person of integrity in your work. You know, 1 Thessalonians 4:11-12 says that we should aspire to live quietly, to mind our own affairs, and to work with our hands so that we can command the respect of outsiders and be dependent on nobody. So through our work, God wants not only to meet our needs, but to use that as a platform for non-believers to see how Christian works. And then last into earning an income is don't try to get rich quick. Proverbs 28:22 says, trying to get rich quick is evil and leads to poverty. The problem with most of us is that the Bible says that our heart is deceitful. And what that means is we can even deceive ourselves. And so some opportunity comes up and we say, oh, it's a fantastic opportunity. And sometimes we can blame on God that he gave us the opportunity. But when the thing goes sour, in our honest moments, we'll admit that we were just greedy and we wanted to get rich quick. Let me say that a lot of these things I'm talking about today, I can talk about because I violated them. I've learned the hard way on a lot of this stuff. And a few years ago, I had some friends making a lot of money, putting money in oil deals. And so I thought, man, I can do that. And so we put some money in, and it didn't turn out too well. But I've got to admit that, you know, when I'm real honest with myself, I've got to admit that I was trying to pick up a fast, easy buck on the deal. And the Bible says that that's wrong. So how do you keep from fooling yourself on that deal? Well, here's some guidelines to recognize the get-rich-quick scheme. First, it's almost always outside of your area of expertise. Now, if you're in the oil business, then great. You'll stay in things in the oil business. If you're, you know, real estate, you stay in real estate. If you're a merchant, then you stay with that stuff. But as a merchant, I have really no business being in the oil business, because I don't know the terms, I don't know the ins and outs of that business, and those guys can take me to the cleaners. So it's almost always outside of your area of expertise. And second, on a lot of get-rich-quick schemes, no money is really made. You're only transferring money around. no goods are produced and or no services are rendered. Now, a few years ago, they had a thing here in Oklahoma City called the Executive $1,000 Club. And you put $1,000 in, and if you talk to some other sucker to join, and you get $500 to his $1,000. All they were was selling the money up the ladder. I never invested any of it. And a friend tried to get me to join. I said, no, that's just a scam, because no goods are produced and no services rendered. So no one's making any money. All you're doing is transferring it. And he goes, well, I'm in it because I want to make money, so I'm going to make a big contribution to our church building program. What he did is he made the money, and then he made a big swimming pool in his backyard. You know, we can kid ourselves that way. We say, oh, I'm going to help out poor old God. But like Wayne said, poor old God doesn't need your help in that way. Some rules to go by on any kind of investment is never risk money that you cannot afford to lose. Never get involved in things that you don't fully understand. Get all of the facts. A lot of times, we're trying to sell ourselves so hard that we just look at the situation through rose-colored glasses, and we really don't even want to know all the facts. And then most important, take your time. You've had guys come to you and it's some great deal, and you're an insider. It's a great deal, but you've got to do it by Friday night, or the deal's going to be off. And just take a pass on that thing. If it's that good a deal, it's going to be around next week. The reason they're putting the pressure on you is because they want to take your money and go south with it. In the handout, there's some information on the working wife. And, you know, the Bible doesn't say where the wife should or should not work outside the home. But I would encourage you to, as a family, decide what your priorities are in every area of your life, as far as your family, as far as your children, as far as finances, as far as your church involvement, socially, and so on. And then see what the benefits and costs are if your wife works outside the home. And I think when you really get down to after tax, after expense dollars, you're giving up quite a bit to gain very little. But that's a decision that every family has to make. I'm 1 minute ahead of time, so I'm going to take a sip here. Y'all want to stand up and stretch?
You got the Gals here for
a
living?
What's that?
The Gals, the Living Bible?
Yeah, it's Living Bible, yeah. On giving, Wayne said everything I was going to say, Deuteronomy 14:23 that he mentioned is the best verse I know about. That the purpose of tithing, in the Living it says, the purpose of tithing is to teach you always to put God first in your life. I promise you, when you got into a man's wallet, you're darn close to his heart, you know. And if you look at your checkbook and see where your money is going, then you can tell what's important to you. And that's why God's not necessarily trying to raise money, he's trying to raise children. Like Wayne says, he's trying to grow Christians. Well, let's talk something about saving. You know, we get that paycheck and we go home. And if you're going to do it scripturally, you're going to do your giving on the front end, like Wayne said. And I agree with what he said. The reason to do it on the front end is because if you don't do it on the front end, there won't be anything left on the tail end. You're like most folks. So you do your giving, and it's a lot of folks standing in line, a lot of bills to pay, house payment, and so on, a lot of expenses. But that's the time to take care of your savings, too. In fact, the best way to take care of savings is a payroll deduction plan at work, but if that's not available, then take care of it on the front end once you get home. A book that I would recommend to you, I don't think it's on the book table downstairs, it's called The Richest Man in Babylon. It's referred to at the tail end of the white sheet, so you don't need to write it down. There's several books back there I'd recommend. But it's a book written in a real clever style, kind of in the style of the parable. It's a story about a fellow who started out as a young, struggling young peasant boy in Babylon, and by hard work and shrewd trading, he became the richest man in Babylon. And so this younger man came to him and asked what was his secret. And so he shares what his rules were. One of his rules was that a part of all I own is mine to keep. So I'm going to work, pay the government, and pay all these other fellows that I'm buying from, then a part I'm going to keep for myself. Proverbs 21:20 talks about the same thing. It says, the wise man saves for the future, but the foolish man spends whatever he gets. Now, there's two kinds of people there. Who are they? First, now, okay, what does the wise man do? Come on, it's not hard. Saves, okay. And the foolish man, what does he do? Spends whatever he gets. Okay. Now, in modern day America, we've invented a third kind of man. Now, who's that? He spends more than, he spends all he gets and then some more. And to do that, he has to go into debt. Now, whether it's on a credit card or at a bank or whatever, he's in debt. So he is worse than a fool. It's the best thing we can say about him, right? According to that verse. Let me say that a couple of things. One is, this seminar is geared toward personal finances, not business finances. And the difference there is that when you go into debt in a personal financial matter, it's for consumption. You're going down to Skaggs and buying groceries to eat. You're going to buy a suit of clothes to wear. It's all outgo. When a business goes into debt, if it's a wise business, it goes into debt to aid production, to make money. And if it's a wise investment, it will not only pay for itself, but it will make money for you. But this is geared toward personal finances. And I would define debt in this context as owing for items which cannot easily be liquidated and owing more than the amount, no, that's it. Okay, cannot easily be liquidated for more than the amount owed on them. Owing for items which cannot easily be liquidated for more money than the amount owed on them. Now, the reason why I use that definition is back to Proverbs 22:7. The borrower is the slave of the lender. What I want to do is get it to where I'm not in a situation where I'm under pressure financially. Okay? Now, about the only item I know that I can borrow money on that would not put me under pressure is a reasonable loan on a home. Okay? Now, you can buy a home, you can buy a big enough home to put you under pressure, but if you're in a home that you can afford, you're not going to be sweating that payment as long as you're not under the gun somewhere else. But you can quite easily get into MasterCard and Sears and Penny's and GMAC and all these people for a lot of money, and if you were to liquidate, sell those products that you borrowed on, it wouldn't pay off the debt. If you go buy a new car and drive it out of the lot, you can't pay what you owe on it. Okay? In 1976, a well-known columnist was searching for a slogan that would typify America in that bicentennial year. Thousands of slogans came in, and the one that was picked as being most descriptive of America in that year was, "The check is in the mail." In 1981, personal bankruptcies in the United States were almost 500,000, which was more than double the record set 2 years before that. According to the Wall Street Journal, the average person seeking help from a counseling service, consumer credit counseling service, is not this poor guy that doesn't make any money. He's white collar, making $15,000 to $30,000 a year. And the head of Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Change in Times magazine said, "Those who come here don't budget and save. In all the years I've been here, I can count on two hands the people who've had as much as $100 in savings." So, you know, it's not a question of not making enough money. It's a question of not handling the money we do make in the right way. Let me give you some signs of financial bondage. First, arguments and nagging about money. Here's one I love. Purchase of new items to overcome depression caused by overspending. It's kind of like overeating, you know. You just phone calls from creditors. Guys, if you go off to work and your creditors call the wife during the day, it's because they want to put pressure on her and get to you. Physical problems caused by prolonged pressure. Overdue bills. And get rich quick attitude. Some reasons to not use debt. First, it enslaves us. I've already talked about that. Second, it's an entanglement with the world. Now, 2 Timothy 2:4 says, no soldier on service gets entangled in civilian pursuits, since his aim is to satisfy the one who enlisted him. Well, as a Christian, my aim should be to satisfy Jesus. And if I am deep in debt to a bunch of lending institutions, then I really don't have the flexibility to do whatever Jesus wants me to do. 10 years ago, a friend of mine here in Oklahoma City came to his senses and realized he was $15,000 in debt on personal items other than his home. Now, if you want to put it in perspective, that'd be about like $35,000 today. So that was a lot of money. This guy wasn't stupid, and it wasn't that he was making money. He owned his own company, had an MBA from Harvard, and was one of the most brilliant guys I've ever known. So he decided he wanted to get out of debt, and the first thing he did was he cut up his charge card. And the problem was that he couldn't spend next month's money to live on because he was already obligated for last month's charge bills. And so he just went cold turkey off the charge card. And I remember going over to his house, and the cupboard was bare. They ate every can of green beans, every cornflake in the house. But they made it through that first month. Within a couple of years, he was able to pay off the debt. A couple of years after that, he felt impressed by God to sell his home, sell his business, move his family to New Zealand. And he went over there as a self-supporting missionary, lay missionary. And now he's full-time with a Christian organization living in Singapore. He couldn't have followed God's direction unless he'd gotten out of debt. Wouldn't be too good a witness to go over and minister to the folks on the other side of the world and leave them to unpaid bills here. So he was able to satisfy the one who enlisted him. Another reason not to use debt, it presumes on the future. James 4 talks about this. It says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and get gain. You know, we're just making all kinds of money tomorrow. It says, you don't even know about tomorrow. And if I go down and agree to pay in 30 days something for something which I've already consumed, and I'm presuming that I'm going to be here in 30 days to pay it, and God's going to profit me to pay it. The best two reasons not to use debt are the last two. You miss out on the adventure of trusting God to meet your need. Philippians 4:19, God says, my God will supply every need of yours according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. God's promised to meet our needs. But how much faith does it take to go down and use a plastic charge card? Anyone here ever prayed about using a charge card? I don't know anyone who has. I was giving this talk one time to a bunch of seminary students. Boy, that's a tough crowd. Because they've always got a spiritual reason for everything they do. So I got to this point, and this one guy says, hey, what about our situation? We're in seminary. We're living on a limited income, and we're in this apartment. My wife has to go down to coin off laundry. We could buy a washer and dryer from Sears, put them in our apartment for what we're spending on laundry, and pay it off in the next 3 years. Boy, they almost had me. And another couple said, well, you know, we were in the same situation a few years ago. And so Sears had them on sale. We thought about going down there, and we thought, no, God promised to meet our need. Let's just pray about it. So they did pray about it, and within a couple of weeks, the family in the church came up to him and said, you know, we've moved in the new house. The appliances are already there. We've got a perfectly good washer and dryer. Would you be able to use it? They hadn't even told anyone. And God met the need without them having to go in debt. So it just takes a whole lot more faith to trust God than to go into debt. Best reason not to use debt is because it's expensive. Why don't we turn to the blue sheets? These sheets are color-coded. If you're in debt, you're blue, and if you're saving, you're in the green, and if you're investing, you're in the gold. But turning the sheet says the debt trap. If you go into debt just $1,000 a year for 5 years, at the end of 5 years, you don't owe $5,000. Because the compound interest, you owe $8,400. Well, let's say at that point you come to your senses and you say, okay, I want to pay it off, and I'd like to pay it off in approximately the same amount of time it took me to get into debt. You'd have to just pay that $2,573 a year for the next 5 years. And that's just at 18%, and there's a lot of interest rates higher than that going around. What does that debt accumulation of $1,000 a year for 5 years cost you? Total interest through the 10-year period, $7,865 cost you to go $5,000 in debt. And worse than that, to pay it off in that second 5-year period, you've got to quit overspending $1,000 a year. Then you've got to cut your spending below that, $2,573. You've got to cut your spending, $3,500 a year, to pay off the privilege of going $1,000 in debt for 5 years. There's two kinds of folks in the world, those who work for money and those who have money working for them. And this is working for money. Well, let's say you're in debt. What do you do? Well, most folks that are in debt don't know where they are financially. That's like most folks that have a problem with weight do not want to weigh because they don't want to know the facts. George C. Shea, who has written some books that are mentioned on the last of the white pages, excellent books. George is in the, yeah, there's one of them, you can be financially free. He's in the credit collecting business in Wichita, and he goes and collects bills that are hard to collect. And he also does some counseling on finances. When someone comes to see him, he gives him this speech, which I plagiarized from George. And he says, you fill this out, and it basically says how much we own, what our assets are, and how much we owe, what our liabilities are. An accountant would call this a balance sheet. If you owe more than you own, then you have a negative net worth, and vice versa. He gives this to him, says, fill this out and come back and see me in a week or two. That gets rid of 75% of them, because they don't want to know the facts. So, let's say you fill that out, and how do you get out of debt? Well, next page, you do that, then what you do, you may need to sell some high depreciating items. You may be driving a Belk Spire 8 automobile, and you may just need a Toyota, or an old Volkswagen or something. You may be driving a $10,000 car, and you may just need transportation. What you may need to do is sell that car. It's possible you could be in a house that you can't afford. You may need to move to a less expensive house. A lot of items, we can't, you know, if we've made a bad buy and we can't help ourselves by getting out of it, and there's no use taking a beating, we might as well just keep it and enjoy it and learn our lesson and not do it again. But these questions will help you evaluate each item, whether you should keep it or whether you should sell it. Then third, make a schedule to pay off your creditors and inform them. Just go in and say, look, here's my financial situation, show them the whole deal. Believe me, they do not want to throw you into bankruptcy. Then they get nothing. They'll work with you. In fact, they'll be so tickled that you called them and came to see them. They'll greet you with open arms because they're trying to hunt folks like you down and not find them. And then stick with your plan. It's not easy to do that, but believe me, it's easier to do it now than it will be a year from now. Lee Holtz, the Arkansas football coach, had a situation a couple of years ago. Someone stole his wife's purse and all of her charge cards were in it. And the thieves started charging stuff all around him. He said, well, have you turned into the credit card company? He said, no. He said, I'm watching. He said, right now the thief's not spending as much as he was, so I figure I'm ahead. These next two sheets here, two areas where people get into trouble as far as debt, other than charge cards, is in automobiles and in houses. And I'd say the chance of getting in trouble on a home is the least likely, because most lending institutions won't let you get into a house you can't afford for the most part. But what does it cost to drive a car? Let's say that you're driving this example, a 78 Impala, and you know, it's got a few rattles and it's got 60,000 miles and you have to do a brake job on it. And maybe a new muffler, and you think, man, this thing's going to eat my lunch, so I'm going to buy a new 83 Impala. Well, these are the actual figures, what it costs in taxes and in insurance and in depreciation and interest costs and so on to own each car for the next 3 years. That's what we're locking in on the next 3 years. Can I make the old one last 3 years more, or do I want to buy a new one? Well, you can see that The old car is going to have an average annual cost of $653. The new car, an average annual cost of $2,954. These figures are before you turn on the key. Now, these are fixed costs. The difference is $2,301. Now, I don't know anyone that spends that much a year for a car to repair it. So let's say you spend $500 to repair the old one if you keep it, then you've got $1,800 extra per year to put into savings and save toward buying a new car. The fixed cost of driving that 1983 Chevy is 10,000. If you drive it 10,000 miles per year, it's 33 cents per mile. That's before gas, oil, tires, and repairs. According to Hertz, it costs 44.6 cents per mile in 1981. 44.6 cents per mile to operate a typical compact car if you drive it 10,000 miles per year and keep it for 4 years. And a full size costs 51 cents per mile. I'm sure those figures are a little bit higher now. So cars are very expensive. How much home can you afford? This next page talks about that. If you read 10 books, you'll get 10 different theories on how much you can spend on a home. But a good rule of thumb is that your housing cost, all costs related to your housing, should not exceed 30% of your gross income. Some folks say lower than that. So this tells you about that. It tells you about different types of mortgages. A fellow came to me a while back and said, "Hey, I bought a house 2 years ago. I sold it, and I owe more on it than I borrowed." Well, that's possible under some of these mortgages now. So you need to know what you're getting into before you get into it. You can read about that. This next page shows what the monthly payment would be to pay principal and interest on a loan, 30-year loan, at various interest rates. So if you got 11% loan, it's $9.52 per month, and that'll help you figure out what your payment would be. And then the last page you can use as a worksheet to figure out what your potential housing cost and what you might be able to afford. All that's for free. So we don't have to pay for that. Okay, let's talk about savings. Savings is just the opposite of debt. Why should we save? Several reasons. One is to operate on a margin. It gives physical and emotional security. You know, it's just not good to always be running on that fine edge where you can fall off. Second, to be available to God to move and minister and give as He leads. Third, to provide for unexpected times of need, which we're all going to have in the last year. Many folks in Oklahoma City have seen that that's the case and related to the oil business. And fourth, to have flexibility to take advantage of special buyings that come along. Someone asked me in one of the classes, "Well, is it all right to use a charge card to, you know, make a special buy if I can buy stuff 50% off? Isn't that a good deal?" Yeah, it is a good deal, but why not save the money up ahead of time? And then you have the opportunity to do that without putting yourself in a bind. The first green sheet, yeah.
I was going to say, can you find 12% for $1,000 now at a bank?
Okay, on this?
Well, like, can you find a bank that gives you 12%?
No, I cannot, but I'll tell you what you can do. If you have a savings plan available to you through your work, like most thrift plans and that type of thing, are making an excess of 12%. Our thrift plan at our business, our employees can put in up to 6% of their income. Whatever they put in, we match it. Okay? The earnings, while it's in the plan, is tax-free. That plan, in the next 3 months, will make two investments. One of them is a 12% investment for the first 5 years, and then it goes up according to the cost of living adjustment. The other one is a 14% return, and a building that it bought last year is yielded a 15% return the first year, and this year, because of the cost of living adjustment, is 16.02. So yeah, if you have very much money, you can do 12%. You're not going to do it on a few hundred dollars, but particularly if you take advantage of some of the tax provision that the government has now, you can do it. It's a reasonable figure, I think, very conservative. If you do save and put in $1,000 a year for 5 years, instead of owing $8,400, you now have savings of $7,100. Now, if you continue that for another 15 years, make a total of 20 years, you'd have $72,000. You would have put in 20 and you'd have 72. You could then withdraw $9,500 per year for the next 20 years. In fact, at the end of 17 years of withdrawals of $9,520 per year, you still had more than the original $20,000 you invested. Because of interest, you would have put in $20,000 and drawn out $190,000. Now, believe me, if you say, well, that's a bunch of optimistic figures, those are very conservative figures. And those who say they're optimistic and don't believe them are the guys who are going to be taking a bath and wishing they'd have done it. I had a fellow call me 2 weeks ago that works for me, been with us for about 3 years, makes an excess of $30,000 a year. And he said, I want to pull out of the thrift plan. So I said, well, that's fine. If you want out, we'll send you money, but I want you to understand what's going to cost you. Now, if he pulls out, I'd make more money because I wouldn't have to match his contribution. But I said, if you pull out, you get $3,000 out. What are you going to spend it on? Well, I'm going to spend it on a car. In fact, he wanted me to loan him the rest of it for the car, and I told him I wasn't in that business. But I said, if you draw out, you're going to lose the matching funds for the next year and a half before you get back in it. But more important, you're going to start over on your vesting. That's a 10-year vesting schedule. I said, do you know if you stay in that plan, I looked it up, for another 22 and a half years from now, you will have contributed $36,000. And you will have in the plan $524,000. And I looked it up, he could draw out like $5,000 a month for the next 20 or 30 years. It was unbelievable. He said, keep it in the plan. I said, that's going to be a very expensive car you're driving if you pull out.
You have to increase the amount of years you're
going to stay in the plan. Yeah. If you are able to get into some kind of employer matched plan, look at this at the bottom. If your annual salary is $20,000 and you can put in 5% of your salary, that's $1,000 a year. If the company matches it, over 30 years you will have put in out of your pocket $30,000. If the company matches it and you earn 12%, at the end of 30 years you've got $482,000. Hey, listen, burning money is better than Social Security. Somebody in the last class said, they looked at some figures later on, they said, you know what? You got more down for, you got 8% down for income tax and you've got 6% down for Social Security. And I said, well, you know that in my company, last month, I've got 120 people working for me. If you take the employer's contribution plus the employee's contribution to Social Security, it comes to around 13% of the income. That amount is substantially more than the amount withheld for income tax. We're all paying more Social Security than we're paying income tax. We don't realize it because we never see it. Yeah, we never will either. Okay, this, let's see where I am. Savings. These gold sheets back here, how to get started in investing or the value of limiting your standards of living, won't apply to everybody, but there's some people who, for various reasons, either they get out of med school and start making quite a bit of money rather quickly, or they're in commission sales and they start doing real well. If you're going along and you're used to living on one standard of living and you suddenly start making more money than that, then don't raise your standard of living all of a sudden. Gradually raise it for a couple of reasons. One is you might not keep making that much money. It's always easier to stay where you are or move up than to move down in standard of living. But this shows what would happen if a fella was living on $20,000 a year and started making $50,000. I know that seems outrageous, but there's some people it applies to. Well, if he'll just give himself a $4,000 raise per year, pay taxes on the whole thing, give on the whole thing, but invest what's left over. At the end of 5 years, he will have a standard of living up to $40,000 that he will have in tax-paid, tithe-paid dollars, $62,000. Now let's say he started when he was 30, so now he's 35. If he'll take that $62,000 and invest it at 10% after taxes for 20 years, he'll have $419,000 without adding anything to it, just his original 5-year savings. All of that from 5 years of enjoying just an 11 to 20% annual rate. Now, I talk to a lot of people and they say, oh, I'd like to own my own business, I'd like to do such and such, but I never could have that much money. Well, the reason the folks... Okay. Someone saved money sometime to get the capital to start that business or to keep it going. And if you're young, you need to start saving now, because the dollar you save now is much more valuable than the dollar you're going to save at age 50. The average American guy who's successful, has a good career, doesn't have a dime to rattle in his pocket until he's about 50, because he's raising the kids, he's paying their way through college, and suddenly, about age 50, he's got the house sitting there paid for, the kids are gone, and he's making more money than he's ever made, and suddenly he's pretty well off, but he doesn't have as long to let that money work for him. So if you're young, start saving now. I would encourage you to give 10% and to save 10%. Good place to start. The last goal page is long-term financial goals for savings and investment. This, again, the basis of this comes out of one of George C. Chase's books, although I customized it a little bit. Proverbs 24:27 says, develop your business first before building your house. And my application of that is that I need to give adequate working capital to my business before I raise my standard of living. And so it's got different priorities to become established in my career. Now, you know, some of y'all don't own your own business, but maybe it's a matter of getting educated for your career. Maybe it's a matter of making some investments, whatever, but get your base of your career established. And then second, own your own house and life insurance. The goal of life insurance is to guard against financial disaster, not to make the beneficiaries independently wealthy. Those guys walk around town with $3 million life insurance. They're going to have to be careful. The wife's going to kill them. And then you need a quick cash backstop for unforeseen disasters. Proverbs 27:12 says, a sensible man watches for problems ahead and prepares to meet them. The simpleton never looks and suffers for consequences. Then you start talking about long-term investments of a non-speculative nature. This would be the IRAs, the thrift plans, things like that. Untouchable money for retirement. And then, last, after you've already taken care of these other things, then you start talking about investments of a somewhat speculative nature. Yeah.
What about on houses? I got to think of just paid cash for a house.
Well, nothing wrong with that. Most of us don't have that opportunity.
Well, is it good to pay off a house immediately, or should you? If you have the funds, or should you just, make the monthly payment and let your money sit in the bank and grow on interest?
Yeah. Well, I just say this. I think it's a good goal to have your house paid for. Mine is not. Very few people have a house paid for. But I wouldn't want to get my house paid for and then go hock it again, or I wouldn't want to take out a second mortgage on my house. The only reason to have your house paid for is just give such security to your family, particularly emotionally. Now, if I've got a long-term mortgage on my house and I can make more money by investing that money in my business than in my house, and I think I'd be wise to put that money in my business, as long as I don't think I'm going to lose it. Okay? Let's say you've got a... Let me compare it to another thing. Let's say you've got a student loan that's a 5% interest rate. I don't know what they're on, but let's say it's 5%. And you're supposed to pay that back over the next 5 years. Let's say you've got the money in your hands to pay it back. What should you do? What I would say is that you need to honor the commitment that you made and pay back that 5% loan month by month by month by month. If I could make 8% in money markets, I'd put it in money markets and gain that 3% spread. I've got some mortgages on buildings that have a 7% mortgage on them. Well, that's cheap today. I'm not gonna pay those things off early, but I am gonna honor my commitment. Okay? But on your home, eventually get it debt free. I think having your home paid for is a good goal, but as long as you've got a good equity in your home, I wouldn't sweat it.
Well, a lot of times I'll have an inflated equity, like my dad bought a house for $36,000, and then 7 years later, it was inflated to $86,000.
Well, a dollar's a dollar no matter where it came from, you know.
Yeah, but there he had an extra $50,000 in equity in the house.
Yeah, he did, but he did, but he really didn't, because if he sold his house and wanted to move into a comparable house, he had to pay $86,000. So, but my dad told me a long time ago, when you take the money to the bank, they don't ask where you got it, they just put it in your account. And so whether you make it on a house or on, some other deal or find it blowing down the street, a dollar's a dollar. Let's talk a little bit about spending. Before we leave savings, let me just mention one thing. Our goal in savings and investing is not to stack up a bunch of money so that we can pack that money and feel good. We don't want to be trusting our savings. If your savings account was at Penn Square Bank about a year ago, you had a hard day one day, didn't you? So we don't want to trust in that stuff. We don't want to worship it. But we do want to foresee the difficulties ahead and provide for them. We want to worship the Lord and don't worship our savings. Let's talk about spending. We talk about keeping up with the Joneses. Well, let me tell you what the Joneses are doing in America today. The Wall Street Journal says that 46% of American families have two or more cars. Now, I remember 20 years ago, someone told my dad, about 25 years ago, someone told him that, sometime in the future, average family is going to have two cars. He couldn't believe it. That's when they were doing one-car garages, And now, almost half of them have two or more. 23% have two or more color TVs. Now, someone's got three color TVs, because I only have one. And in fact, until about 4 years ago, someone had four color TVs because I didn't have any. Someone's probably got, three or four for you guys. 8%, one out of 12 of American families have two or more houses. Again, someone's got three houses because I only have one. But it's no wonder we can't keep up. You're not going to keep up with the Joneses because the Joneses are going broke. They just don't know it yet. When you talk about spending, Proverbs 16:9 says we should make plans, counting on God to direct us. So make plans, have a budget. If you'll turn to that, I think it's back in the green sheet on the back of savings, says planning your spending. The first thing you've got to do is figure out where your money's been going, And you take your checkbook for the last 6 to 12 months and categorize your expenses. So much, food, eating out, clothing, the various categories, shelter, automobile, so on. Categorize. And then you may look and say, good night, I'm spending 5% of my income on gifts. Set your wife down. Have her start knitting or something like that. But once you see where your money's going, then you say, well, that area is not as important as what I'm spending on it, so I'm going to cut it. If you figure out a budget, if you're normal, you're going to figure out that you need about $200 a month more than you're making to make ends meet. So what you're going to have to do is do a little whittling. There's some questions here that you can ask. As far as shelter, can I afford this place? Do I need to move to a less expensive home? So on. Whittle on it and get it to match. Now, these target percentages of income on budget items, I've read a lot of books, and no two of them agree. Some guys say no more than 27% of your income for housing and all kinds of figures. And so these are some that work. But your situation is going to be unique. You may be a person that will spend a lot more on clothing and not as much on housing. And you may be the other. I know some people that kill themselves on housing and absolutely don't spend dime anywhere else. The key is to get in your giving, get in your savings, try to pay your taxes now, and make it come out to 100%. You'll notice on this thing, it's got 4% on this particular deal. So, just whatever you feel that would work for you, just get it whittled down. And then keep records. The Bible says, get the facts at any price and hold on to all the good things you can get. And so get records and know what's happening. Proverbs 13:9 says, it is pleasant to see plans developed. As far as spending, throw away your charge card. Pay cash. You don't have to pay 18% interest.
Sometimes, I know that's easy to say, but let's say you're writing a check of money that you have in the balance. You know, you're going to be able to pay for it, but then they'll say, well, don't you have any more out of the paper?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do there?
Well, I'll tell you what. Number one, if you trade, if you live in a certain area, the people, the merchants in that area are going to know who you are. A lot of stores have check cashing cards. You know, so that's one answer. Secondly, it's not evil to carry a charge card. I carry them. I use them. I use them this week for expenses that are going to be reimbursed by my company. I rarely use them for personal reasons. When I do use them for personal reasons, I'll go home, write a check, and throw the money out of my bank account. I won't be surprised when it comes next month, when the bill comes. And within a couple of years, they're not going to have charge cards. They're going to have debit cards that immediately take it out of your bank account. They've already got them right now. But I will say this. If you cannot carry a charge card and handle it in such a way that it does not increase your amount of spending and put you in a bind, then I wouldn't carry it. I just start using green stuff. You know, no one's ever turned down green cash. And I'll tell you what, it's the easiest thing to spend is money with a charge card. It's easier to write a check than to spend cash. I have a harder time parting with green cash than I do with a check for spending. That's why if they like it, charge it. You're going to spend more money if you just, oh, that's great. No. Bill Trails existence. A few years ago, my wife was convinced we needed Childcraft books. His former coach had told her that, and so I said, fine, honey, if that's what we need, then we'll buy it if we still want it in 30 days. And so 30 days went by, and she didn't buy it. In fact, before that time, she went to a Bible study and told the girl, she was praising me or telling them how unreasonable I was. And one of the ladies said, well, man, I've got two sets of Childcraft books, and my boys are older now. You can have one of them if you come get it. And that's been about 7 years ago, and we never did go and get it. So Bill Sales Resistance, I've got to admit to you that about 3 months ago, a little old lady smacked in the shoulder and said, Evan. So it ruins a little bit of my story. In conclusion, the key is to get God's perspective on our finances. Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be yours as well. And you know, we can be different from the world. We won't have the pressure of bills, and we won't be scheming to get rich quick, and we won't be building our lives around money and possessions. We won't be jumping off a building because the stock market went down. And we won't be in a situation where all we can pay is just the interest on our charge card. But we'll have financial freedom. We'll be able to keep the financial side of our life in the perspective that God wants us to keep it in. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you that you're interested in our finances. And God, I pray that each of us here would just commit that area to you and look into your word and see what you have to say about it. You have the courage and discipline to follow through. Amen.